Je pense qu'on va commencer. Je vous souhaite un bon après-midi. My name is Will Straw. I am director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. And I would like to welcome you all to this year's Fulbright Lecture in the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. Je vous souhaite la bienvenue à notre conférence Fulbright de l'Institut d'études canadiennes. We are particularly delighted to have Dr. Michael Stamm deliver a lecture entitled From Forest to Newsstand, The Canadian Origins of the American Newspaper. Now, Dean Manfredi will tell you more about... Is there something? Is this sound strange or not? Okay. We'll tell you more about the Fulbright lecture in a moment. But first, we are hosting a large number of other lectures throughout the month of March. In fact, we're thinking of branding it as Miskapalooza. Tomorrow, Professor Bill Weiser, historian from the University of Saskatchewan, considered by many the leading historian of Saskatchewan, is going to deliver a lecture entitled A Tale of Two Futures, Saskatchewan in 1905 and 2005, which will be at 4 p.m. in the Faculty Club Gold Room. On March 21st, Noah Richler will deliver the annual Mallory Lecture. On March 25th, Dr. Claire Campbell, who is here, will deliver this term's Eakin Lecture. And on March 27th, Professor Robert Leckie will be giving a talk at MIT. So for more information, we have lots of pamphlets at the registration desk. You can check our website and so on. We will also be hosting a small half-day conference entitled Does Bilingualism Have a Future? Commemorating the 50th anniversary of the launch of the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism on May 1st. There's lots to attend, but let's turn now to this event, which I've been looking forward to ever since I first met Michael. But I'd first like to invite Christopher Manfredi, the Dean of the Faculty of Arts, to say a few words on behalf of the faculty.
Thank you very much, Will. It's always a pleasure for me to participate in an event held by the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, where I spent six great years in the old house on Peel Street. And I'm particularly happy to welcome you here to the Fulbright Lecture. The MISC has hosted Fulbright Lectures since 2006, and the Fulbright Scholars Program has helped in raising MISC's profile both locally as well as in the United States. The Fulbright Program offers the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada an annual visiting chair focused on public policy and fields of mutual interest to Canada and the United States, in order to further the development of MISC's program and research. The major benefits that MISC realizes through the Fulbright Visiting Chair are the intellectual value of integrating a dedicated researcher into ongoing areas of scholarly pursuit, the increased public visibility the Institute gains by having noteworthy scholars addressing issues of current debate and importance, and the long-term benefit of ongoing academic ties with the United States in areas of mutual interest and concern. And Michael joins a distinguished list of former Fulbright lecturers, including U.S. Ambassador to Canada David Jacobson, Karen Kodrowski, Raymond Cox III, and Stephen Farnsworth, among others. So it's a pleasure to be able to be a part of this, to be able to listen to the lecture, and to take some time away from other things that are on my mind these days. So with that, I'd like to welcome Will back and introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Dean Manfredi. I don't know if you know how Fulbright works, but basically there's a time of the year when I, or people in other departments, get a number of applications of people who are looking for to be Fulbright fellows, and some of them, you know, look more or less interesting. When I saw Michael's, I jumped out of my chair. I was going to say out of my pants, but I didn't. out of my chair, and getting to know him over the last few months has been one of the great delights of this year, as well as getting to know his partner Ani, who is there, a professor of political science. So just to say a bit about Michael's life and career. He's an associate professor in the Department of History and the School of Journalism at Michigan State University. And in fact, looking at this room, I see represented the two parts of Michael's interest, a number of communication scholars, professors, and students, a number of historians, as well as friends of MISC. Michael received his BA in English from the University of California, Berkeley, his MA and PhD in history from the University of Chicago, the McGill of the Midwest, as it's known. His doctoral dissertation was awarded the Margaret A. Blanchard Doctoral Dissertation Prize for Best Dissertation in Journalism and Mass Communications by the American Journalism Historians Association in 2007, and the book based on this research is known to many of us, Sound Business, Newspapers, Radio, and the Politics of New Media, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2011. Broadly speaking, Michael's research focuses on two areas, the political economy of news and journalism, and the consideration of new media in historical perspective. And his articles on these subjects have appeared in the Historical Journal of Film, Radio, and Television, American Journalism, Religion, and American Culture. Michael is currently writing a book tentatively titled The Metropolitan Newspaper in a Global Economy, which traces the history of the 20th century newspaper as a product of industrial capitalism. And I believe the paper today is related in part to that. So I just ask you to invite me in extending a warm welcome to my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Michael Stamm.
Thank you all so much for coming. I wanted just to say a quick thanks before I get started to Fulbright Canada for their generous support and to the MISC board for allowing me to be here this year and to the staff for making it such a wonderful place to come every day. And particularly I'd like to thank Will for making it just such a fun work environment, creating such a great environment. It's been the most intellectually rewarding year I've had in the profession. I can't thank you enough for that, so thank you. So this talk is based on a book that I'm writing right now, and in both, I'm trying to connect two histories of the past century that aren't often understood to be related. One of these is the history of the metropolitan newspaper in the United States, and the other is the evolution of the trade relationship between the United States and Canada. So to connect the two of these things involves doing two things. It involves remembering what a newspaper was in the pre-digital age. I use the term industrial newspaper. And it involves rethinking North American trade after 1911. This is when trade reciprocity between the United States and Canada failed to be realized. A significant individual commodity was made duty-free soon after, and that was newsprint. And that would provide a tremendous boost to both Canadian paper manufacturers and to American newspaper publishers for the next century. And it would provide a powerful example for policymakers to invoke when promoting free trade agendas throughout the century. So the book and the talk more generally are an attempt to balance a history of the 20th century newspaper as a product of North American natural resources and trade, with a specific focus on the Chicago Tribune and its publisher Robert McCormick, pictured here. The choice of this narrative focus is not arbitrary. As I hope to show, the paper and its publisher were central to this related international history. McCormick took over as the publisher in 1911, the year that reciprocity negotiations failed, and he would remain so until his death in 1956. His family had owned the paper since the 1850s, but during his lifetime, it became one of the highest circulating and most important daily newspapers in the United States. One of the lingering reminders of the paper's success is the Tribune's neo-Gothic tower, completed in 1925, and still a distinctive feature of the city's skyline to this day. If you walk down Michigan Avenue in Chicago, it's still one of the most noticeable buildings in the city. The Tribune Company's success under McCormick was due in no small degree because of a strategy of aggressive vertical integration, including the control of raw material supplies of newsprint from Canada. This was an era in which newsprint supplies and prices could fluctuate dramatically, both due to market forces and due to rationing programs imposed during the two world wars. And the Tribune always ensured itself a stable and affordable supply of the single most important input to its business, and really to any newspaper. This is the largest line item in the production of a metropolitan newspaper of the early 20th century, is its newsprint bill. So having access to newsprint helped the Tribune become arguably the leading voice of American conservatism and isolationism in the New Deal era, and it also enabled the company in 1919 to begin publishing the New York Daily News as a wholly owned subsidiary. The Daily News was the first tabloid newspaper in the United States, and it was for a time the highest circulating newspaper in the entire country. These are two of the most famous examples of the paper. These are known to many historians and people. The one on the left is the Tribune's overly enthusiastic proclamation that the Republican, Thomas Dewey, Dewey had defeated the Democrat Harry Truman in 1948. The famous photo is Truman obviously holding that issue up. And the second is the New York Daily News' 1928 photo of Ruth Snyder executed at Sing Sing Prison. It sold 1.5 million copies that day. It was the highest selling daily newspaper at any point in history in the United States to that day. And it was taken by a photographer who smuggled a camera in on his ankle and then took the photo of Ms. Snyder. So both of these things are not only cultural, they're cultural touchstones. You often see them in journalism history textbooks. But if you look at them as material objects, their history traces back from the point of purchase at an American newsstand to a tree in a forest in Ontario, or more likely in Quebec for the one on the left. So much of this work that I'll be presenting today talks about that, and many of the photographs that I'll be showing are drawn from a major archival collection that has just opened to researchers in the last couple of years, or is in the process of opening in Ottawa. And I've been the first researcher to use them, and many of these photos are unpublished photos from that collection of Tribune Company activities on the North Shore of Quebec and in Ontario. So as research that looks at both communications media and Canadian staple goods, this is obviously a project that follows quite firmly in the steps of Harold Innes, and it's a subject at hand that ties together the two major themes that run throughout the Innes corpus, and one of these is the political economy of staple commodities, and the other is the history of communication. And you see this connection show up in some speculative form throughout his work in the 1930s, but by the time he was writing The Bias of Communication in 1951, which was published in 51, he had arrived at the idea that there was something particularly important about the relationship in the connection between the relationship between the history of Canadian staples exploitation and the history of Canadian and the history of communication. He was writing this as the subject of his presidential address to the American Economic Association in 1952. He died and didn't survive to deliver it. It was published the following year, however, in the American Economic Review, and in it you can see the outlines of some of the connections that Innes was making. In the essay, he talks about the exploitation of staple raw materials, as he called them. And for him, the chronology was fish, fur, lumber, wheat, minerals, and pulp and paper. So he had started with the histories of fishery and the fur trade in his early work, and he was convinced that the political economy of his own era was defined by pulp and paper. And he had some good reasons for doing this. In the 1950s, pulp and paper production was Canada's leading industry and accounted for nearly half the value of all Canadian exports to the United States. Having access to Canadian newsprint, Innes believed, was an essential element to the rise of the mass circulation daily newspaper in the United States and was integral in tying the two nations together in a trade relationship defined by U.S. exploitation of a significant Canadian natural resource, the forest. And I hope to pick up on some of these themes today in a very limited and modest way. This is a photo of, excuse me, of the spring log drive in Quebec. And it represents the natural origin of those two papers I just showed you. We often call newspapers now dead tree media, and this is sort of a colloquialism that we often use now in the Oxford English Dictionary even. It's a trope mostly used to portray newspapers as these lifeless and static remnants of the past in an era of vibrant and participatory digital media. But there is a literal truth hidden in this, and newspapers really are the products of felled trees, and a century ago, that's all they were. There was no practical way to deliver content to a mass and dispersed public on a daily basis without newsprint. Today, a newspaper is not only something that we access as text on print, but it's something that we access on these. We all found out about the Pope, for example. I don't think any of us found out about the new Pope, for example, by reading a printed newspaper, but we found out about it by reading the newspaper, right? But until well into the 20th century, if you wanted to publish a newspaper, you needed a factory, and you needed a great deal of paper, and this was getting adequate supplies of paper was a persistent problem for the newspaper business throughout the 19th and the 20th century. Until the middle of the 19th century, newsprint had been made from cloth rags. You could make a very clean and very good piece of paper out of cloth rags. The problem is there's only so many of them. And the penny press, as the penny press begins to rise in the 1830s, publishers need increasing amounts of paper, and they're increasingly anxious about the supply and the cost of the paper that they can get. So they found an alternative in 1839 when a German inventor figures out a way to make paper out of wood pulp. And over the following decades, papermakers increasingly switch over to making their paper not from rags, but from the more radically and plentifully available material of wood. By 1880, the majority of papermakers had switched over to using wood to make their paper, and this dramatically expanded the amount of paper available, and it dramatically expanded the amount of information circulating publicly in printed newspapers. So in 1879, when the process of making wood-based paper had become more or less the dominant one in the industry, North American newsprint manufacturers produced roughly 150,000 tons of newsprint in 1879. 25 years later, using almost exclusively wood, papermakers on the continent were producing almost 1 million tons of newsprint annually, and this rapidly increasing supply of paper helped to enable the era, for better or worse, of yellow journalism as defined by William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer. By the late 1940s, Newsprint mills in North America were producing roughly 5.5 million tons of newsprint annually, and Canadian manufacturers were prone to making such boastful but true claims that, quote, each day we make enough newsprint to cover a two-lane highway from Vancouver to Halifax. So in the 20th century, the daily newspaper was enabled by advances in the mass industrial production of newsprint. And this industrial aspect of newsprint is often forgotten today. But it's important to remember that in making newspapers into the important institutions they were socially and politically, publishers adapted almost all of the strategies and tactics that any other manufacturer did in their business. Newspapers became powerful institutions because of the owner's application of industrial technologies and the harnessing of raw materials. Publishers needed dead trees to feed the machines. So because of this incessant need for large supplies of newsprint, newspapers like the Tribune, like the Chicago Tribune, came to have an influence not only on society and politics, but also on the environment and on North American trade. Many of the most available stands of trees in the early 20th century were not as well fit to make newsprint in the United States. So the Douglas fir of the American West and the pine of the American South had wood that was too dark to make desirable newsprint without a great deal of chemical processing. In addition to the transportation costs associated with getting a very heavy and bulky commodity from the West Coast and the South to the Northeast and the Great Lakes region, where most of the metropolitan regions and major newspapers were located 100 years ago. Spruce proved to be ideal, and the location to make the newsprint, and the location of it along and north of the U.S.-Canada border, especially along the Atlantic seaboard and the Great Lakes region, made the tree particularly attractive, and it made publishers begin to seek the raw materials for their newspapers increasingly north of the U.S.-Canada border, and it increasingly began to draw U.S. publishers into arrangement with Canadian paper mills. So what U.S. publishers eventually did was to produce an industrial commodity, and the material history of this commodity is in some respects an interesting echo of some of the arguments that Karl Marx offered in Capital, a book published in 1867 during this conversion from rag-based paper to wood-based paper. Capital is about a lot of things, but it's, at the core, it's a study of the commodity. And the commodity, Marx says, hides what it is. He says it's at first sight, quote, an extremely obvious, trivial thing. A commodity has a value expressed in money, and if I give you the appropriate amount of money for that commodity, I take possession of the commodity that I desire. And the simple exchange, however, elides the commodity's social and material history. And Marx tries to make his readers aware of the metaphysical subtleties that commodities have. When he first introduces this concept in Capital, under the concept of commodity fetishism, as he calls it, he starts with the example of a wooden table. And he says, it's absolutely clear, that by his activity, man changes the form of the materials of nature in such a way as to make them useful to him. The form of wood, for instance, is altered if a table is made out of it. Made from wood by human labor, a table becomes a commodity exchanged for money, a, quote, thing which transcends sensuousness, as Marx put it, and the human labor and the raw materials are obscured in the transaction. The same is true of the printed newspaper. The difference is that it offers us something different than a place to put our lecture notes or our wine glasses after a lecture. It offers a daily vision of social and political reality for those who buy them. So in some respects, this is a project that traces the newspaper as an industrial commodity and its capitalist metamorphosis from the Canadian forest to the American newsstand. And it starts, as I'll talk about now, in Baie-Comeau, Quebec. I'll talk a little bit more about Baie-Comeau in a second, but I just want to show this visually. This was the Chicago Tribune's paper mill up in Baie-Comeau, Quebec. And one of the few advantages, if there are one, of having a pulp and paper company extract resources as opposed to, say, a petroleum company is that there are staff photographers at a newspaper to take nice pictures of it. And so these are some of the photos taken of the operations at the Tribune's mill in Baie-Comeau, Quebec. So they get they're pulling the logs out of the forest into the mill. These are then made into paper, these massive paper rolls, which go into these mills that sort of, these warehouses sort of look like the end of Indiana Jones. They're then put onto boats where they're taken to Chicago, and you can see this is the Chicago Tribune printing plant. You can see the Tribune Tower in the upper left of the frame and the paper being unloaded at the printing plant along the Chicago River. And then this is being unloaded at the same reels being unloaded in New York at the New York Daily News plant. And what you get is this. So a tree might make a table, but it also might make things that shape our ideas about things about such as war and peace, as these two front pages from December 8, 1941 demonstrate. And what this also means is that for almost 100 years now, a few months short of 100 years now, we've had an integrated continental economy in newsprint, and that our local newspaper, the thing that is really this, it has the name of our city in it, is a product of global industrial capitalism. So as purveyors of industrially produced commodities, U.S. publishers were in many respects similar to automakers. Both groups used factories. Both wanted steady, predictable, and affordable supplies of essential raw materials, many of which could not be found readily or affordably in the United States, but which could be found elsewhere in the hemisphere. This motivated Henry Ford in the 1920s to try, ultimately unsuccessfully, to build a rubber plantation in the accompanying company town of Fordlandia on 2.5 million acres of government-granted land on the Amazon River in central Brazil in order to make tires for his cars. And this is also what motivated Tribune publisher Robert McCormick to seek timberlands in Canada. And the aim was the same: control the production process as much as possible through vertical integration down to the most basic elements needed in production. Now, the fact that McCormick even had the opportunity to go to Canada to do this had to do with a significant shift in thinking in state policy about the tariff from 1911 to 1913. So policymakers in the U.S. and Canada had discussed trade reciprocity at various points, and they had operated under the Elgin-Marcy Treaty, a free trade pact from 1854 to 1866, when the U.S. abrogated it. And free traders on both sides of the border in subsequent decades tried to get free trade and reciprocity reinstituted. Picks up momentum in the early 20th century. And by 1911, U.S. and Canadian policymakers had come to an agreement about trade reciprocity that offered free trade in many natural products, and in such as wheat and produce, as well as in manufactured newsprint. The U.S. Congress approved the pact. When it goes to the Canadian Parliament for approval, conservatives in Parliament mounted spirited opposition, the outcome of which was that pro-reciprocity prompting the Prime Minister, Wilfrid Laurier, to call an election, the outcome of which was that pro-reciprocity liberals were trounced at the polls, conservatives came into power, and reciprocity failed. And it would fail. The 1980s were seen by free traders as the big return to the failure of 1911 in Canada. Now, Canadian voters recoiled from reciprocity and its liberal proponents for a variety of reasons, not the least of which was the fear of annexation by the United States, and this is a fear that was not as irrational in 1911 as it is a century later. In 1911, the U.S. was in the middle of creating a global empire in the 13 years after the Spanish-American War. The U.S. had taken possession of colonies stretching across the Pacific to the Philippines. In the Western Hemisphere, the United States was organizing its few remaining territories in the Southwest into states. It had spread out into the Gulf of Mexico and in the Caribbean with Cuba, with Puerto Rico. Under the Roosevelt Corollary, was taking an increasingly aggressive stance toward Latin America, including, perhaps most egregiously, the supporting of the creation of Panama and the construction of a canal through that. This was an empire that was both territorial and capitalist, to use geographer David Harvey's terms. So when Champ Clark, who was a Democratic member and soon after making these statements the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, made the intemperate and rather buffoonish remark in February 1911 that he, quote, looked forward to the time when the American flag will fly over every square foot of British North America up to the North Pole, some Canadians took this literally. Rejecting reciprocity meant not only rejecting a trade relationship with the U.S., it meant rejecting being made a part of the U.S. So reciprocity failed, this is, again, free trade in natural products and finished manufactured newsprint. That fails in 1911. However, 2 years later, the U.S. Congress passes the Underwood Tariff, which removes the import duty on printed newsprint, and all of a sudden we have a continental economy in newsprint. And this, in many ways, had to do with aggressive lobbying on the part of publishers to Congress to get free trade in what was essentially the most significant input to their business. The massive U.S. market is now open to Canadian production on newly advantageous terms, and the center of North American newsprint production soon moves north of the U.S.-Canada border. Canada becomes the world's leading producer of newsprint, and by 1938, manufacturers in this country were producing more newsprint than their nearest four competitors combined: U.S., Britain, Germany, and Finland. And this is a position that Canada would retain for decades. The vast majority of this production goes directly south to the United States. So you get the failure of reciprocity in 1911, but you get the removal of the duty on newsprint in 1913, which provides an immediate boost to what becomes the leading industry in Canada and provides U.S. publishers with essentially free trade in the most important element to their newspaper, to their business, and it gives us an integrated continental economy in the most important constituent part of the newspaper business for now almost a century. And this is where the Chicago Tribune then becomes central to the story. So Robert McCormick takes over the paper in 1911, and the city of Chicago is growing rapidly, and he's got big designs for the paper. He's dismayed by the failure of reciprocity, but he's gratified in 1913 when newsprint is then made duty-free, and he thinks he's going to take advantage of this new duty-free status of newsprint. So what he immediately does is to build a mill on the Welland Canal at Thorold, Ontario, so right in the middle of Chicago. It's the lower left on the shore of Lake Michigan. Of the frame. This was situated both close to the affordable power offered by Niagara Falls and easy access from the waterways for both the trees coming out of the forest and then the finished paper, which could then be taken along the Great Lakes from Thorold, Ontario, down to Chicago very cheaply and very affordably. So the Thorold Mill gave the Tribune a steady newsprint supply, and it allowed the company to better rationalize its production and its operations, but the paper needs that it had were still greater than the mill's initial capacity, and it still had to purchase some paper on the open market. So the company's also finding ways to become vertically integrated. It also faces additional challenges in needing paper when it starts the New York Daily News in 1919. The demands of publishing these two papers created an extraordinary need for paper. The internal estimates that the company made were that by 1940, it was using 672 million pounds of paper annually to print these two papers. The Daily News was the highest circulating paper in the country, the Tribune was second, and the two put together were using some 672 million pounds of newsprint, about one-tenth of all of the production the consumption in the United States, and the vast majority of this came from Canada. So during this period, officials within the Tribune Company begin scouting out additional timberlands to get the trees to put into their Thorold mill, and they begin to make a number of scouting trips around Ontario and Quebec. And this is publisher Robert McCormick on the Manicouagan River on one of these scouting trips in 1923. So through negotiations with provincial policymakers in Ontario, the company eventually obtained 1,800 square miles of timberlands on several locations around the province, and these are the sort of the green blotches in the map. The largest of these was at Heron Bay, which is situated on the north shore of Lake Superior, but they've got a couple other large timber limits scattered throughout the province. In Quebec, the company obtained timber leases on the north shore and ultimately controlled some 6,000 square miles of forest there. This is this large. It's not necessarily the largest parcel of land by the standards of Quebec geography, but it's about the size of the American state of Connecticut. The location of the Ontario leases offered easy transport from the forest to the mill at Thorold. But having this large tract of forest in a location with convenient access to the Atlantic and to New York City motivated the Tribune to consider building a second mill in Quebec to complement its Thorold factory and more directly to supply the New York Daily News. Why should you take all of the logs to Ontario first when some of the paper had to go to New York? You can bypass that journey in the Erie Canal simply by putting the paper on the Atlantic Ocean and taking it down to New York City. So the area around Thorold, the Tribune is beginning to consider the possibility of developing something on that land and using that land for more than simply a place to cut down trees. The area around Thorold had been developed decades before the Tribune built its mill there in 1913, but the remoteness of the Quebec location also motivated the Tribune to become a regional planner. And this was a tantalizing opportunity for the publisher, for Robert McCormick in the 1930s, as exploiting the North Shore offered not only commercial advantages but symbolic political advantages for a conservative publisher. In the United States, this is the year of the Tennessee Valley Authority, and Quebec offered McCormick a chance to show the world how much better the private sector could do regional and economic development than the public sector. See, McCormick hated the New Deal. He was probably one of the most single important and most rabid anti-New Deal public figures in the United States during the 1930s. And with the platform he had as the publisher of the Chicago Tribune, he loved telling the public why he hated the New Deal, and he did that quite often. Franklin Roosevelt's administration Tribune editorials repeatedly and consistently claimed was transforming the country into a, quote, economic and political dictatorship. McCormick saw nefarious purposes everywhere in the New Deal, but his attitude about federal planning and spending on public works elicited particularly shrill remarks. Among these loathsome public works programs was the TVA. It's one of the signature programs of the early New Deal. It's an extraordinary effort to use federal spending and authority to transform the entire region of a country. The basis was the construction of a series of hydroelectric dams along the Tennessee River, which at the time only had the Wilson Dam at Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and the subsequent use of this cheap power would then be used to develop the region and to develop industry there and to develop settlement there. It was a very sort of backwards region at the time. So the town of Norris, Tennessee became a particularly focused point of hatred for McCormick. It was a town that was needed. It was built by the New Deal. There's a series of these New Deal towns you find scattered throughout America. Norris is one of the most prominent ones of them. It was the first construction project undertaken by the TVA. It was needed to house workers who were building the Norris Dam. That was the first major project that the TVA had undertaken. But it was also something that was going to be used as a laboratory to show how New Deal principles could be reflected in the built environment. It was going to show how social and economic justice could be encoded into a city built by the federal government as part of a regional economic development plan. The town was to be integrated into its natural surroundings, and housing and services were made to be provided to residents affordably and efficiently. It was built in 1933 and 1934, and it was aimed at being a concrete example of how the federal government could improve Americans' material lives. But this is not how McCormick saw it. To him, the structuring of the lives and the lives of citizens in planned communities like Norris demonstrated that, as one of his editorials put it, quote, there is no longer room to doubt that the communism of Lenin and Stalin has taken root in the United States. Can anyone doubt that in the inaccessible mountains of Tennessee is being grown the germ culture that is intended to infect America? like 15 years before McCarthy. Created 13th, created and allegedly controlled by the federal government, the town of Norris came to symbolize everything that Robert McCormick came to despise about the New Deal and programs like the TVA. And this is where we get back then to Baycomo. So it's somewhat ironic that while lambasting the TVA in editorials in 1937, the vocal anti-statist Robert McCormick is himself funding and building a well-planned town in Canada for workers at a new mill that's built by the Tribune Company, and it brings industrial development and hydroelectric power to a region that had almost none previously. This is a photo of the construction of Baycomo. It's a rather remote location. There's very little industrial development at the time. It's about 250 miles downriver from Quebec City, about 420 miles downriver from where we sit today. Building Baycomo and exploiting the region involved the Tribune building private hydroelectric power on the dams in the regions, and its development as a whole in the 1930s represented the largest private undertaking in all of Canada since the Depression had started in 1929. And this is really, if Roosevelt was to have his TVA, McCormick wanted his as well. By 1940, the Tribune Company estimated that it had spent some $150 million on materials, wages, and taxes on its projects in Canada, or something on the order of $2 billion in contemporary dollars over the course of that decade. And it rarely avoided opportunities to tout its success as a U.S.-owned private enterprise stimulating the Canadian economy. And these are some of the photos of the company. Again, this is the advantage of having a newspaper do this as opposed to some other sort of corporation. You begin to see the town taking shape along the waterfront. The construction of they had to build everything. There's literally nothing there when they got up there. And then this is downtown Baycomo a decade after the town had been built. Many visitors to Baycomo marveled at what they perceived as the quality and the efficiency of the planning, and almost as soon as it was built, it elicited wonder from some observers. A correspondent from the Montreal Gazette visited the town and was impressed, remarking that, quote, walking along the main street, one passes the brand new bank and the town hall and the church. There are women's dresses in the windows of the shops, the latest from Paris for the ladies of Como, and you can go for a stroll through the residential district, past neat little houses and fresh coats of paint. Amazing changes have taken place in a year. The wilderness has been tamed. By 1948, after roughly a decade in operation, the town was flourishing. The former wilderness now had, in addition to a new newsprint mill and a robust housing stock, a full range of municipal facilities and private stores, and a number of civic associations and religious organizations had started in the region. At Baycomo's official 10th anniversary in 1948, the Financial Times noted that, quote, the old province of Quebec is reaping the benefits of the enormous expenditures of American capital, and the francophone paper La Patrie called the town a, quote, testimony to private industry. Though some praised Baycomo and the Tribune's role in developing it, there were many who criticized this, however, both in terms of criticizing U.S. foreign investment in Canada and the accompanying environmental degradation that projects such as this caused. Opposition members of the Legislative Assembly of Quebec accused Premier Taschereau of cronyism with the Tribune Company, one of them remarking that there were, quote, two forces at work in the destruction of Quebec forests, the first being forest fires and the second the American interests. And these sorts of criticisms continued for decades after in Quebec. By 1948, Harold Innes had begun writing about the pulp and paper industry, and he offered an assessment of newsprint production in Canada that was, for him, strikingly clear and polemical. And partially through the development of that industry, Innes said, quote, American imperialism has replaced and exploited British imperialism. And as a theorist of communication, as well as of staples exploitation, Innes believed that the increasing usage of this particular Canadian staple had unique consequences that fish and fur had not. Increased supplies of newsprint, Innes argued, quote, accentuate an emphasis on sensational news. Succinctly put, world peace would be bad for the pulp and paper industry. And in one of the most direct attacks on the Tribune Company specifically, a citizens group on the North Shore wrote an open letter published in the paper La Côte Nord, assailing the company's power in the region. Everything is monopolized there, and the Tribune Company is master and God, and the company is the dictator. Despite the criticism, Robert McCormick and the Tribune Company continued to aggressively develop the North Shore in the 1940s and the 1950s. As Innes had suggested, the absence of world peace was indeed good for the newspaper business and in the World War II era and the prosperous decades after. The Tribune and the Daily News needed ever-increasing amounts of paper to meet ever-increasing public demand for their newspapers. Starting in 1944, Robert McCormick began pushing provincial officials to allow his company to build a new hydroelectric dam on the Manicouagan River in order to generate the necessary additional power to allow the mill to expand production. Construction for the dam began in 1948, and when it was completed in 1942, the immodestly named McCormick Dam ultimately provided so much surplus generating capacity that the Tribune Company began soliciting partners, partners from other companies around the world who would come to the North Shore and make use of that power. So the company representatives go around the world trying to find companies who want to come to the North Shore of Quebec to use this power that it has, because the province won't allow it to sell the power. But they say, if you can get someone to come and use it, go nuts. And so the company representatives start seeking anyone who wants to come up there to use that power. They negotiate with some 40 companies around the world in the early 50s. And in 1954, the company partners with British Aluminum Company, which decided to build a $31 million aluminum smelter in a town site right next to Baie-Comeau. This is a company that had extensive bauxite deposits in the British Gold Coast, which is now present-day Ghana, in West Africa, and was looking for a place to smelt this bauxite. It's the raw material for aluminum. It was looking for a place to smelt the bauxite into aluminum. It had been considering building this smelter either in Norway or in Africa, but economic and political factors stood in the way. And there's a memo I found in the archives where a Tribune Company executive reports on a meeting that he had with officials at British Aluminum. He writes back to his superiors that, quote, they are reluctant to invest in low-cost power sites in Africa and Norway because of the political factors and the length of time to develop the power. They fear Africa because of the black man's ascendancy and the insecurity of any investment made there. Norway is socialistic and the interference of government is terrific, end quote. Conditions in Quebec seem more agreeable to the company, and the combination of cheap hydroelectric power and an immediately pro-corporate provincial policy convinced British Aluminum to come to the North Shore in 1956. They built a massive aluminum smelter. And that's the smelter sort of in the middle of the frame up there. They built an accompanying town site just downriver from where the existing plant was. British Aluminum's partnership with the Tribune Company created a jointly owned company called Canadian British Aluminum, or CBA, which thus brought aluminum production into an American newspaper company's diversifying corporate structure and extending the scope of its staples-based operations. Over the following 4 years, CBA spent an estimated $100 million on industrial development in the region, and its operations were given widespread acclaim in the business press. And one of the great ironies of this in the early 1960s is that it takes place at a historical moment when there are many francophonic Quebecers who are becoming increasingly radicalized, drawn to anti-imperialist and anti-colonialist thinking, often through reading the works of people like Frantz Fanon and Albert Mamie that have origins in North Africa. And at the same time, you have a situation where thousands of workers in the province are themselves participating in a global colonial economy involving the research exploitation of bauxite from West Africa brought to Quebec and then sold on the global market. And this is all a process initiated by a U.S. publisher coming to Canada because he wants paper to print his newspaper back home. So as a way of getting toward a conclusion, I'd like to talk briefly about the idea of newspapers and communities. Among contemporary scholars, one of the most influential theorists of the cultural functions of the newspaper in the last couple of decades has been the anthropologist Benedict Anderson, who argues that newspapers create what he calls imagined communities of individual readers who understand themselves to be part of a larger whole through the daily act of reading. The newspaper reader is ever unsure of exactly what his or her fellows are doing on a given day, but still retains a sense of community with them through the daily act of reading news and information in a common language. There's a lot to be gained by thinking about newspapers in this way, and I think many of us probably have relationships with certain media outlets that do still approximate this. We are part of a group that reads a certain newspaper. It does involve, however, thinking about a newspaper in a particular way. It's important to remember that in the way that as newspapers are the foundations of communities of readers, they are also the products of mass production, of industrial production, and one that requires raw materials for that production that are often gathered or were gathered in a global economy. In creating corporations to operate under the conditions of industrial capitalism, in the 20th century, publishers built not only communities of readers, but communities of workers. In Baie-Comeau, the Chicago Tribune built not only a newsprint mill, it built schools, churches, hospitals, and houses. It's not in any sense an imagined community. It's an entirely real planned community. And it's one that in the course of several decades reshaped and one might even say devastated the natural landscape of a region of Quebec. Manufacturing and industrial newspaper involved attracting workers and their families to come live in this part of Quebec. later involved building a major hydroelectric dam to generate new power, to bring new, even newer development to the region in the form of aluminum smelting. And in thinking about a newspaper as a foundation of community in this way, it becomes something that's much more terrestrially direct. And this is a sort of way of a form of usage, a usage of this term community that was invoked by Quebec Premier Jean Lesage visiting Baie-Comeau in 1962 on the 25th anniversary of the founding of the town. And Lesage came and he praised the Tribune Company for what it had done in the region. And he said, quote, "A community which was no more than an unmarked and unnamed indentation on the shore of the St. Lawrence River 25 years ago now contributes as much as $75 million each year in industrial productivity to the province." Lesage saw an even brighter future ahead for the region and for the province. And at the same time, he also looked to the past, praising Robert McCormick for his initiative and his planning in the region. Quote, "It would not be difficult to say that McCormick contributed to more than a town when he approved the plans for Baie-Comeau. I think this town will remain for a long time as a living memorial to Robert McCormick." Besides the town itself, there remain in Baie-Comeau and the area around it two symbolic monuments to Robert McCormick on the North Shore. One of these is the hydroelectric dam that bears his name. And the second of these is a more curious sort of symbol. It's a statue of McCormick in the harbor at Baie-Comeau on the waterfront. It was dedicated in 1956 after his death. It's a monument to his arrival on the North Shore in the era of the scouting trips, rather than a monument to the corporate reorganization of its space and the exploitation of its resources. This was an executive who spent much of his adult life in bedrooms and in mansions. Corporate boardrooms and in mansions. It's probably that too, right? Sorry. Boardrooms and mansions. Bedrooms as well. The statue that memorializes him in Baie-Comeau, however, is an 18-foot statue of him rowing a canoe. There's an aerial photo of the memorial that I think places the achievement in greater perspective. The memorial is now in the lower right-hand corner of the frame. In this image, it's set off from the industrial activities that clash harshly from the natural landscape that his company had exploited and transformed over the series of a few decades. Beyond the physical monuments, McCormick's lingering presence in Baie-Comeau filtered out in some other significant ways into policies that affected all Canadians and all North Americans later in the 20th century. The company ultimately had effects not only on the environment and the economy of Baie-Comeau and Quebec, but also of Canada, as they would have significant influence on Brian Mulroney, who became the Prime Minister in 1984, signed the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement in 1988, and then negotiated the basis of the North American Free Trade Agreement in 1992 before leaving office. Mulroney's father, on the left, Benedict, was an electrician and was one of the first Tribune Company employees in Baie-Comeau in 1937. This is a photo taken of him in 1957 that hung on the mill wall. It's his 20th anniversary service photo that was hung on the wall of the mill office. 30 years later, in 1987, Brian Mulroney praised his hometown of Baie-Comeau as a place that provided a vision for Canada's participation in the global economy. In Baie-Comeau, Mulroney claimed, quote, "We've always known the importance of international markets. We lived by them. We've always known the importance of foreign investment. We saw it in our jobs and in our very lives." In his 2007 memoir, Mulroney attributed some of his thinking along these lines directly to the Chicago Tribune and to its publisher. Mulroney wrote that the Tribune publisher Robert McCormick, quote, "influenced every part of Baie-Comeau life. Though derided today by many as some sort of 20th century Republican robber baron, McCormick was in fact a larger-than-life figure who dreamed the great dreams necessary to carve a thriving community out of bedrock and forest on the North Shore while building a newspaper empire in the United States." Applying the lessons, some of the lessons that he learned from one of America's foremost newspaper publishers, Mulroney would then help to reshape the histories of North American trade and Canada's role in the global economy. One needs to be careful in assessing statements like Mulroney's. I'm not quoting them to practice armchair psychology or to make the case that Mulroney's childhood is the key to understanding North American trade. Instead, it's to point out the rhetorical use of Baie-Comeau and developments like that in Canadian politics to sell these sorts of things, to sell the beneficence of American corporations to citizens and voters who are often skeptical of these sorts of things. And this had been the case in Baie-Comeau for decades. Throughout Baie-Comeau's planning and development, McCormick and his executives had been very friendly with Premier Taschereau. They developed very cordial relationships then as Baie-Comeau's construction drew closer to Maurice Duplessis, pictured here. Duplessis was the Quebec premier who ruled the province, I think, with a degree of centralized authority that was far greater than any of the most caricatured New Deal autocrats that McCormick skewered in his pages in the States. And McCormick and Duplessis never, as far as I can tell, were never close personal friends, but they did develop a warm working relationship. They shared a staunch anti-communism, and each used the other to his advantage. McCormick got his industrial development, and Duplessis was able to consistently tout it as an example of how public-private partnerships between his province and American corporations worked to Quebec's benefit. This was at a speech in Baie-Comeau at the opening of the CBA smelter in 1958. Duplessis denounced critics of American corporations while touting their contributions to Quebec. The extremists speak against foreign investment, Duplessis claimed, while, quote, the province of Quebec believes that American capital is doing good in the province of Quebec. Now, the question of whether American investment in Quebec or in Canada has been good, I think, is something that remains open. And I think there are many who would disagree with Duplessis. But American corporations and American capital certainly were doing something in Quebec. And perhaps the best way to understand what the Tribune Company was doing in Quebec was through two pairs of photos. The first of these, taken in April of 1937, shows the outline of the construction of what would become the paper mill in the spring when they were beginning the construction of the mill. The second, taken in October from, I guess, about the same vantage point, shows workers dwarfed by the size of the machinery that went into that building that was constructed. So you get in the first image the outline of a newsprint mill sketched into the cleared land of what had just recently been a forest, and the second shows an industrial interior and an industrial mode of labor that are entirely new to the region. And then in the second pair, one can see the transformation of the landscape around Baie-Comeau, one taken in 1931, and then the second taken in 1962. From the air, the town looks as well-planned as any New Deal town, with its curvilinear streets harmonizing with the landscape, the mill area clearly defined, four neat piles of logs stacked behind the mill, awaiting industrial processing. Over the course of several decades, the Tribune Company imprinted itself upon the landscape of Quebec to obtain the materials it needed to print newspapers in Chicago and in New York, and to establish itself as one of the most important media corporations in the hemisphere. This was the American newspaper operating as an industrial concern in a global economy, and this is the Canadian origins of the American newspaper. Thank you. Thank you.
I now invite you to ask questions, make comments. We have someone who will come around with a microphone. I would ask you to identify yourself before intervening. And I think we'll begin with the woman here.
Thank you. My name is Nadia Alexan. My name is Nadia Alexan. I'm the founder of Citizens in Action, and I disagree completely with what you have said. First of all, Duplessis was giving away our forests and our resources for free. The companies that you say did good for the people, you did not speak about the pollution, you did not speak about the pittance they were giving to workers, you did not speak about what kind of benefits, what kind of protections they had when they died in those factories. And the problem now with newspapers, and you said it yourself, is that the concentration of papers, newspapers, in the hands of one or two moguls who are always preaching their own brand of ideology, and it's always against the people. And there are different. You don't speak about the pollution and the destruction of the of nature with those dams and those and this machinery. And right now it's the concentration of newspapers in the hands of one or two moguls that is the problem in Canada. More than anywhere else in the world, we have this problem. And it's an affront to democracy, because when you have the voices of one or two people and the rest of the people have no voice, then this is not a democracy at all. And free trade was good, yes, for business, but it was not good for the majority of Canadians.
No, I think maybe we misunderstand. I am very critical of this corporation. I mean, I thought I was attempting to point out the latent hypocrisy in the fact that you have one of the most vociferous critics of the New Deal, one of the most vociferous critics of one of the most significant attempts to create social and economic justice in the United States. Ironically, what I actually think it is hypocritically. I mean, I was trying to point out the latent hypocrisy in what he was doing, not celebrating. I think maybe that isn't what I said. I said there is an idea that Duplessis was putting out to the public that business was good, and I think many would disagree with that. And I think in many respects I would put myself into that category. I'm not trying to celebrate at all what this company did to the environment or to the workers of Canada. I think what I was trying to do was point out how hypocritical it was that you have this man in the United States criticizing the exact thing that he is doing in Canada, and the only reason he can do it is because of state policy about the tariff. So you have an anti-statist taking advantage of state policy, giving him free newsprint, and then coming to Canada to then do that. So I think we actually probably agree with each other. I wasn't trying to at all celebrate what was done here in environmental terms or in economic terms. I'm in fact very critical of these. I was trying to point out how hypocritical, in fact, this company was. So, but yeah, I think we probably agree with each other about much of what you said.
I know, Michael, you agree more than I thought. Other comments or questions? Yes.
I'm Bill Buxton, Concordia University. You talked about the American ownership of newsprint plants in Canada. To what extent was this an issue in terms of American ownership as opposed to Canadian ownership? To what extent was there Canadian ownership in the newsprint industry within Canada or within the pulp industry? For instance, Abbott-Price, what was its ownership structure? Or was it just rampant Americanism in which they basically just did what they wanted without any limits in terms of buying land and property for their own uses?
The largest producer was the International Paper Company, which is a multinational concern that had started in the United States, but there was significant Canadian production. The Abitibi Corporation, later the Consolidated Pulp and Paper Company, Spruce Falls Pulp and Paper, which was 50% owned in Canada and 49% owned by the New York Times. But there was a significant domestic ownership of the industry in Canada, but there also, I don't know the statistics off the top of my head, but I do know that the largest by far paper company was International Paper, which was a multinational concern that operated on both sides of the border. But there was significant ownership by Canadian corporations of these corporations.
Elspeth Heman in history. I just want to say that was fabulous paper. Really wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I wondered about the profile of Baie-Comeau in American newspapers, allied, rival, critical. I wonder if there was a genuine interest in the little company town that could, or how that followed up.
There was a pretty significant amount of coverage of the paper, of the town in the Tribune and in the Daily News during McCormick's lifetime. He loved to sort of demonstrate his technological might by showing the production of his paper, the production of, they would run these articles periodically, these well-illustrated articles called like From Trees to Tribunes or something like that, where they would have these sort of like prosaic accounts of what was going on, you know, in the woods origins of the paper. But I think to your point, they would always elide the real political economic conditions in the country and the environmental costs. They would cover it to the extent of showing, you know, look what we can do to nature to bring you the Tribune. And these things slowed. These things slowed quite a bit. I think this seemed less impressive, perhaps after, you know, television and cable television, to sort of demonstrate what you could do to trees to make newspaper. But in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, in the pages of the Tribune, there was quite a significant amount of coverage of Baie-Comeau. Thank you.
Darren Barney from Communication Studies. Wonderful talk. I want to ask you a little bit of a question about this community business that you ended your talk with. I think it was really great the way in which you showed how, in this case, the newspaper made a community that wasn't at all imagined or tied to the kind of shared experience of its content, but really was about its material plant. Along those lines, I mean, the other thing that you demonstrated in the talk is that Baie-Comeau was linked by networks of commodity movement and in supply chains and movement of capital and goods that kind of made it a community that was part of a kind of transnational network from a very early stage. And I'm wondering if if you have any evidence of or could talk a little bit about ways in which that lended a kind of political cultural specificity to Baie-Comeau relative either to the rest of Quebec mm-hmm. or the rest of Canada. You alluded to it a little bit talking about Brian Mulroney and his how this made him favorable to free trade. But I'm thinking about beyond that. Is there mm-hmm. something special about Baie-Comeau that arises from its situation as part of this kind of transnational network that arose from the way in which its economy was structured?
Yes, I think perhaps the main way was the predominance of Anglophones in a part of Quebec that you would not have expected to find them. One of the things that the Tribune did as part of this attempt to really demonstrate how well it could do as a private regional developer was it actually wanted to show that it could build a town that had harmonious relations between Anglophones and Francophones and Catholics and Protestants. So when it was encouraging settlement, it would send out these flyers printed in English on one side and French on the other side to try to attract a bilingual and bi-religious workforce to the province, and they were always talking about this. I mean, Mulroney would talk about this in speeches. He would say, you know, this is a place where hard work, you got what you got through hard work, and everybody got along, and it was sort of, again, a little bit prosaic, but there was a kind of multilingual and multicultural aspect to it. It's probably a little bit like the way Duluth, Minnesota is, being an international port on Lake Superior, that you go to this kind of place that's very remote from the rest of the world, it seems like, and yet you find a kind of culture there that you would not find to this day. And from what I gather, I'm hoping to visit in the spring after the thaw happens, but from what I gather, there is still a pretty significant Anglophonic population in Baie-Comeau and the area immediately around it, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that the initial settlement was made to be, if not global, at least sort of multicultural or multilingual in a way, in that sense. But I don't know how, but I hope that answers the question.
Yes, thanks for your talk. Brian Mulroney worked for Iron Ore Company after. Mm-hmm. So this is 50 years ago sort of thing mm-hmm. you're seeing. And Duplessis did roughly the same thing. We think of giving it away. Mm-hmm. They promised to U.S. Steel. Mm-hmm. They're going to charge him a royalty of 1 cent a ton of iron ore, mm-hmm. which was absolutely nothing. But they promised them, because they're charging them, oh, we're going to give you cheap labor mm-hmm. for 1 cent a ton. You see, you have to appease the Americans because they're going to pay some.
Yeah.
So it was a kind of a did we take full advantage? I'm not speaking as a Canadian, of course, and I'm a mining guy. Did we get our fair share? That's what I want to know.
Did the Canadians?
Yeah, the Canadians, well, we got jobs. We got cheap labor. But did we get a fair deal? I mean, free trade, as a result of free trade in the pulp and paper industry, it was very volatile, eh? And as you know, that was the pulp and paper industry was the biggest success story in the mm-hmm. the world as far as the business was concerned mm-hmm. over the years. Now, right now, it's dead for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
But it was very successful for the shareholders.
Yes. No, quite frankly, I don't think that Canadians got their fair share out of this. I mean, I think that in many ways these were the deals were always very favorable to American corporations, and they were negotiated that way. I mean,
he decided it was 1 cent a ton. He decided himself, like a dictator.
Yeah, well, the Americans had the capital. I mean, that was the sort of it was a power game. I think at the end of the day, these U.S. corporations, Canada had resources that Americans wanted, and the Americans said, "We have the capital. We will come there and build the factory." I think at the end of the day, but you know, in a place like Baie-Comeau, there was always an understanding that this was something that was done for the benefit of the Americans. It was understood in the town, for example, that all of the executives that worked in the town were Anglophones, and the people who worked in the mill.
Now they're spending $500 million in Baie-Comeau for the iron ore business to all the iron ore to China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think these corporations went there not because they had a particular desire to invest in Canada. They wanted the resource, and the resource was in Canada, and state policy helped grease the skids for them to get to Canada to get the resource. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Michael. There's a lot of echoes in Eastern Canada. Obviously, mm-hmm. the Port Hawkesbury Mill in Nova Scotia has been the big question, and Cape Breton was one of the most multicultural regions mm-hmm. in the country around the turn of the century because even though it's remote, it was, the major industrial work site. But I'm thinking about the really stunning contradiction between the memorial mm-hmm. to McCormick and the memorial to McCormick, right? Mm-hmm. And how the town, I mean, again, the wonderful denial of all the rhetoric and development of industrial progress by romanticizing that sort of foray into the wilderness,
yes.
which presumably McCormick both had nostalgia for, but was very intent on eliminating, you know, mm-hmm. for the
yes.
methods of for profit. So I'm just wondering, I mean, was there any reaction to the town in this contradiction, or how it's sort of registered with you as a historian?
You mean in the sense of did people in the town understand McCormick to be sort of?
Well, I guess, you know, you're going into work when the whistle blows,
oh, yeah,
and you're
yeah.
looking at this guy who's
yes,
sort
yes.
of out there in his canoe, and you're, you know,
yeah,
and
yeah.
you're sort of wondering
yeah.
how exactly that's supposed to explain the landscape around you.
One can imagine that there was a fairly jaundiced view taken by many, but there were also many who really did, I think, believe that, you know, the town was built at the depths of the Depression. It was built in 1937, and there were people who would take any work they could get, and there were people who still lived in the town whose parents and whose grandparents had gone up there for that sort of work. And so there was, there was a genuine sense of being glad that there was some sort of job there. But yes, I think there was also, I don't have any direct evidence of this. I'm actually hoping to get into grievance files from the employees in Baie-Comeau that I was not allowed into the first time around, which I have gotten permission to get into the second time. And I want to find out what happened in those. I mean, I want to find out what happened to the guy who, you know, got his hand cut off or something like that, or find out about the people who tried to negotiate for better wages in the town. And I think these are in files that I'm hoping to look at this summer. But the town was just a monument to the guy. It's McCormick High School. The Catholic Church is named after his dead first wife. I mean, it's just, you know, for how much the guy talked about dictatorship and Franklin Roosevelt, I mean, you go to this town and it's just McCormick. There's more McCormick stuff in Baie-Comeau than there is in Chicago. So.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Great talk.
Thank
I
you.
Really enjoyed it. And actually, the photograph that you showed of Jean Lesage, having just given a talk mm-hmm. or a lecture at my class this morning on Quebec history and about the Quiet Revolution mm-hmm. and their opposition, at least ideologically, to U.S. Business.
Mm-hmm.
And then there I see a photograph with Jean Lesage,
yes.
you know, riding that little truck with McCormick by his side.
Moment.
So did that not clash? I mean, did that not generate a reaction on behalf of people, as I would imagine. Yeah. Anyway.
It's a great question and one that I actually have on a list of things to follow up on, like investigate Quiet Revolution. There were people at that. I mean, Pierre Valliere did not specifically mention the Chicago Tribune Company, but he did specifically mention in his book what his antipathy, he did discuss his antipathy towards the pulp and paper companies and what they were doing. And I believe that book was published in 1964, 67. Is right in that era, and so there were contemporary voices that I know that were critical of Lesage era politics towards places like Baie-Comeau. But it's a great question. That's actually one of the things on the list of like need to go investigate this, because it is sort of contradictory, right? That you have this guy going up there and putting a hard hat on, and you know cruising around in a bulldozer, and then saying very different things when he comes to the metropole about foreign investment and about politics, and then going up there and saying these sorts of things. I don't know the answer to that. It's a great question.
Okay, perhaps one final question here.
Thanks. Blair Rourke, I'm a retired economist. You hear stories about the company towns controlling everything, like mm-hmm. the commerce and all that type
yes,
of thing,
yes,
the stores and that type. Did McCormick and his Chicago Tribune control the commerce and other activities in the town or not?
Great. No, and it was specifically by design. The counterexamples that he had available to him for what a company town looked like when it didn't work were right in Chicago. There was Pullman, which is right at the edge of the Chicago city limits, built in the 1890s by a railroad car magnate. There were massive riots in Pullman in 1893 over people who got tired of the discipline imposed by the factory bell and then having to go to the company store. And the other example was Gary, Indiana, which is right next to Chicago, developed by U.S. Steel with no real plan or no real attempt to create any sort of infrastructure for the social lives of workers. So when they went up there, they specifically, and I have all this in the internal corporate memos, they wanted what they called an open town. They didn't want workers to believe that they were shopping in the company store. They really wanted to encourage private development. And again, I think there really was an attempt to use this town as a laboratory for private development. This really was an effort to show the private sector can do this so much better than what's done in the public sector. And they very much by design, housing was meant to be stuff that the houses were sold to workers. They were not company. They were built by the company, by a subsidiary company, and then sold to workers who then paid mortgages and then eventually owned the homes. Businesses were all privately owned. And this was very much by design so that they could tout this as, look how great this town works. You know, just let private industry go nuts. We can have a whole host of Baycomos all over the place.
Okay, well, one of the wonderful things is that Michael is going to be around for still a few more months, so I'll continue to learn about Canada from someone from our neighbor to the south. I'll ask you in a second to join me in thanking Michael again, but I'd like to present you with this. I realize it's a dead tree medium, but it's a token of our appreciation. So thank you very much, and before I say that, I'll invite you to join us outside for a glass of wine. And I'll say what I've been saying the last few times. Don't run up and crowd Michael with questions and comments. Let him get to the wine, and I'm sure I'll be happy to stand around and talk to you then. So thank you very much, Michael, for this wonderful talk.